The quote of the year. I'm not going to Orlando. I'm not with the systematic racism, and I'm not with the bullshit.
Yeah.
Wow. That's Kyrie Irving. There's secondhand sources. I think it's very important as we get this conversation started. I wrote about this earlier this week. Soap on Deb reminded us all that this is all a lot of secondhand reporting on what Irving's been saying.
And a lot of Woj, a lot of ESPN.
Yeah, and so Irving's usually cryptic language is even going through more layers now. So I think that's what we have to view this lens toward. And it is very interesting to think about what the ultimate end to this is for Irving. Does he want the season canceled? I don't know. Given that he wanted to be there with the Nets earlier in the week, I think it's tough to say that, even though it indicates from the quote that he wants to see this ended. But
no, he said, furthermore, he said that if they think it's a good idea, he'll go. But they need to consider it.
Yeah,
there's so much more to what was being said. And at this point, you and I are tapped into this. We have been for a while now. A lot of NBA writers have been showing who they actually are. And a lot of NBA media has been showing, you know, what they're actually about during this. Because the second Kyrie, you know, the quote started to come out that he was maybe against what was, you know, going on in terms of this bubble situation. Who was it from FS1? Jason McIntyre said he quit on LeBron, quit on the Celtics. And it's like, yo, this is not basketball. This is not even close to the same thing. It's like, he's black. He's the NBA PA VP. He's the one who lives this experience. There's hundreds of other people on this call who agree with him. We see Lou Will on Twitter agreeing. Dwight Howard. Dwight Howard lost the mother of his children to this virus. He came out, wrote a whole letter. Like, there are more important things than this return to NBA. And obviously, you and I have talked about it. We've both been very excited about basketball coming back. And for so long, we've said, I just want basketball back. I miss it. But if these players, if the people, the predominantly black NBA players don't feel that it's okay in this climate to continue on, and they feel like their voices need to be used otherwise, that's what needs to happen.
I know I heard on ESPN's podcast too, I think Tim McMahon made a probably good faith argument that players can come back, and this has been echoed in a lot of other places, and use the podium and the platform.
How often does that work, Bob? And I hate to cut you off. They wore the t-shirts for Eric Garner, and that was a problem. Miami put their hoods up for Trayvon Martin. That was a problem. Cap kneels at a game. That's a problem. No one wants to see them protest on the court, on the field either. Everyone says, oh, their platform's never bigger. Until the media, who's supposed to amplify their platform, supposed to be the ones, the reason they have a platform, are like, shut up and dribble, essentially. Not in those words, but close.
Well, there's three things at play here. The coronavirus, the league's return, automatically becomes a major story alongside this, especially in sports circles. ESPN and others have been forced to cover this because it's the only thing going on, where their initiatives back to Colin Kaepernick have been that we're going to avoid politics. Blackness is going to be relegated to the undefeated and these other side platforms. And it's only returned to this place because there are no sports to fill those lanes. So that's the first concern. Second is that the players don't necessarily own the protest, the protocol, everything that's going to happen when the league does return. Like Silver, I think we imagine Silver's going to be sympathetic to it, and that it's going to be allowed because the NBA is a little more lenient on these things.
Look how this season started.
Yeah, and that's an interesting case too, because Hong Kong comes around and James's authenticity gets questioned because I felt he didn't necessarily have the knowledge or backing to comment on that. Maybe that is something that he should have been criticized for, but I think it was reasonable to assume that he didn't have enough knowledge. I don't know. Like, all of a sudden your authenticity gets challenged at multiple different angles. And let's just keep it simple for number three. Do we really not think that blocker charge, Giannis MVP, coaching decisions, those aren't going to become major stories in parallel? Like, I've been dreaming of Enes Kanter rebounding. Like, these goofy little things that don't have all that much importance in parallel to, you know, social discussions. It just naturally becomes the conversation. How easy is it to just start talking about basketball? I mean, we could have been doing it these last 3 weeks. It would have been so easy.
So easy. There's people, that's all they want. There's so many media members and so many fans who just want the game to come back to drown out everything else. And that can't happen because this is so much bigger than basketball. Obviously, it's a good it's a good way. It's a feel good thing. It's good to see, you know, these guys, you know, back on the court. It would be great. I'd love to watch basketball.
So you have to consider
not at the cost of their will, not at the cost of what they want to do. Summoning all these guys to Orlando in an already dangerous situation when they feel like their voices and their platforms can be used better elsewhere feels so wrong.
It's tricky too, because there is no good decision here. Silver admitted that as much. If they don't go forward with this, there's labor strife next year. I think the players like Irving and James have a prerogative as union members to serve their lower level players. And those players have reasonable fear to go a year and a half without salary. And that is certainly possible if the league doesn't move forward. So those are two things that these players have to weigh. Like, are we going to do what we need to do from a social position? Are we going to do what we need to do to back up our fellow players? And those both are very heavy, you know, inspirations for these players. Like, they have to do both of those, and it's not going to be very easy to do both. So I look at what Irving's saying. We need to hear from Irving, as Sopan's going to say in our interview with him forthcoming. But I think it's just the vice president of the union starting the negotiations. We're not playing unless this is going to be integrated into the
product.
He's
doing his job.
Yeah.
He's doing his job.
Holding the NBA accountable for letting this be a big topic of discussion when the NBA returns, because the natural flow of things is going to make it easy to forget about it. And the players are going to have a very difficult task when it comes to the president watching them on TV and subtweeting everything they do and the pressures of the political media that are going to come up when they press these issues in the basketball environment. History tells us that's how it's going to go. I don't think it's tough to imagine. But just like we have to invent a new reality where mass lack of fans for the next year or so, all those different things are going to become more normal. I think we're going to have to normalize a basketball coverage environment where these things are a little more normal, as we would cover the MVP race, as we would cover any of those other sports stories during this time. This is probably going to be integrated into this podcast for a long time. I mean, you have to rationalize.
Our podcast
a new
is based
normal.
On our podcast. We speak predominantly about basketball and hip hop. It has to become a normal part of this forever. You know what I mean?
Sopan Deb is with us today. He has a great new book out. He has covered Trump. He has covered a million different things. So it'll be interesting to hear what he thinks about journalists getting arrested in the street like he did in the 2015-16 cycle. This Kyrie situation, there was so much to talk about with him. He's one of my favorite basketball writers. He has an intriguing story, and I really recommend you get his book because it is funny. It's not easy to read something and laugh out loud like I did with this one in the first quarter. So he's up next here on Dome Theory. Make sure you subscribe to us on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, realbobmanning.com. All those links are up there as well as Audio Boom. Follow us at Dome Theory. And we will talk to you next week on the other side, Taylor.
Peace.
The greatest journalism credit I ever got in my career was Sopan Deb giving me a pat on the back for checking how to pronounce his name before we got on the air. I mean, that's just a smart journalistic and podcasting move. We talked probably a year ago. I mean, it feels like at least a year ago at this point on the Celtics Blog podcast. I don't remember what we talked about, but here we are on Dome Theory with Sopan Deb, New York Times sports reporter.
It feels like we've aged like 20 years since we last talked.
It's funny. I think when I last saw you, we were at the Celtics facility at one of the last practices before the whole thing got shut down. You were there talking to Kemba.
Yeah, I was there. You know, I did an interview with Kemba Walker. Did a big sit down with him. And then I think the season got canceled like a week later.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and the whole world just kind of ended. it feels like years since that last thing.
But what has the time been like for you since things have started flowing?
I'm in very much a position of privilege. You know, my fiance and I have been down in South Carolina at our family's house down here. We came down here in March or so. And we've been very lucky. Look, you know, we work in a very unstable industry. right? And, you know, I think something like 50,000 journalists have lost their jobs in the last 2 months or been furloughed or whatever. And I have not been, you know, look, the so far, you know, I still have, I have my health, I have my job. Like, I'm fortunate, you know, I'm very much in a position of privilege in a way that, you know, a lot of people would be lucky to have. So I just keep reminding myself of that whenever things, you know, feel pretty bleak.
Yeah, for sure. And if you have something to do during this time, I mean, that's just bonus. I mean, you got responsibilities, you got a job. Like, those are just things that can help you get through this with some level of routine. Like, the loss of routine, I think on my end, for a lot of people, has really been what's thrown this for a loop. Like, you wake up at a different time every day and you don't have a place to go. All of a sudden, things start feeling a little more slow. Like, it is tough on the head, especially if you're coming out of college. Like, could you imagine? You get into this a lot in your book that just came out. Like, could you imagine you being in that spot coming out of college with what's going on right now?
I feel terrible for people that are just coming out of college, like you. And you know, I talked to some other college grads who come to me and say, look, like, you know, I worked really hard in college. I had this internship and that internship. Like, how do I get hired? And I'm like, I've got nothing for you right now. I don't even know what to tell you. Because every place is shrinking, it's not expanding.
I've been throwing around pitchers for a while now, and like pitching's gone. And so I'm looking at this, and I'm like, you know, there's no jobs out there. Maybe I can pitch, but pitching's gone too. And it's like, ooh, this is a lot to deal with right now. But yeah, that's the scariest part, is you look to the best of the best in this industry, and they're just like, I'm kind of in the same boat.
Right, man. I hear you.
So you put out your first book in April.
I did, yeah.
That's something. It was,
not the most ideal time to put out a debut book. But you know what? Again, this is one of those places where I'm like, you know what? Like, if that's what you're worried about, that your book launch didn't go well, like, things are going pretty well. So, you know, look, I'm really grateful that the book came out and it received a pretty good reception. I have no idea how much it sold, because on launch day, I told my agent and the editor, the publishing house, do not tell me. I never want to know how many copies it sold. I never want to know. Don't ever tell me, because I don't want to corrupt any of this process at all. I had such a, it was such a meaningful experience to write the book, and it was such a, and for people that don't know, that are listening, the book is called Mistranslations, Me and the Immigrant Parents Who Raised Me. It's a memoir that tracks a year of my life as I try to reconnect with my estranged immigrant parents, and has a part about Hasan Minhaj, and it's you know, I love the writing process, and you know, it was really great to see it reach a whole bunch of people, and I'm getting, you know, I still to this day get messages from strangers, for people saying that they read the book and loved it and whatever. So I'm grateful for the process. I'm grateful that it got this far. I wish I got to do some more events that, you know, I didn't get to do, but you know, that's how it is.
It's funny, man. It really is. There's a few moments in there where you just laugh out loud. And that's not something you get often when you're reading a book, because frankly, and I find this interesting, this duality you put in there very early on, that you're a journalist, but you're also a comedian. Mm-hmm. And you also put your life out there in a very, you know, forthcoming, transparent way, which I don't think a lot of journalists do. I think quite a large amount of journalists see themselves as journalists in a public light, so they kind of keep their lives and who they are on the backdrop, or any other interests or hobbies or stuff like that that they have. But you know, you're very out there in, you know, stuff that you do on the side, your family life, who you are. And I don't know, where does that stem from with you think?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, obviously, when you write a memoir, it's weird when strangers email you or message you and they're like, oh, man, say hi to Wesley for me. Wes is my family. Like, I'm like, what? And I'm probably too open about stuff in a way that, you know, I mean, when you write a memoir, you're writing all about yourself. And you're really deep, dig deep. But so be it. You know, I try not to insert myself into my reporting, and those are two different things. Like this memoir, while it was a reporting exercise, I don't view it as me doing it as a New York Times reporter. I viewed it as me telling my own story.
Yeah.
So, Yeah. I mean, I know certainly some reporters don't like, you know, putting personal stuff out there. That's totally fine. It's all personal choice. Like whatever you feel comfortable doing.
Mm-hmm. So you can get it on Barnes and Nobles, as my friend Anthony Obas would say. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it all these places. I mean, we're really living in a dystopian world right now. So Ben, where you get this book on Kindle and it underlines the parts of the book that it really wants you to hone in on, the different lines. It's a very surreal experience where Amazon's telling me what parts of this book to highlight. I want to highlight on my own. But what was the genesis of this project for you? What inspired it?
You know, so basically my parents were arranged to get married in the 1970s. They had a really toxic arranged marriage. They both came here from India. So I grew up without ever getting to know them at all, because we, even though we lived in the same house, we barely spoke. They never got divorced until 30 years later, because South Asian culture kind of frowns on divorce. And so, and then in my 20s, because I never knew them very well, I kind of just fell apart from them. We just fell out. We just didn't speak much. And then as I was turning 30, which was a couple years ago, I realized that this didn't sit well with me anymore. And that, you know, I thought they might pass away soon. I didn't even know where they were living when I started writing this book. I didn't know where they were, whatever, what they were doing. And so I decided, you know, I didn't want them to die without me trying to get to know them. So I reached out, and the book, that's essentially when the book starts, is when I decided to reach out to them. And this book is different than traditional memoirs, because this truly does track a year of my life, and it's all based on notes and recordings and whatnot. Whereas a lot of other memoirs are just like, you have to do a lot of recall. When I was 6, this happened. When I was 10, this happened. And 15, whereas this was like, this is very genuinely captures my experience in that year of trying to find my parents. And I thought there was something, you know, this is not the book of, you know, about every single brown person. And it's also not a book just for brown people. I think that the book has some important things to say about the experience of being a child of immigrants and mental health treatment and forgiveness and all this stuff. So I just want to document the process, and I thought people might find it interesting.
So when you're arriving in India, when you're calling your mom for the first time, those were experiences you were expecting to document in some way. This isn't just something you went back on.
I told my parents ahead of time that I was going to document this process for a book. Mm-hmm. So they knew what was happening the whole time.
So I need you. I haven't gone through the whole thing yet. I'm about halfway through, and I need you, because you put it in the book in one way, but I actually need to hear you do the imitation of when you're meeting your dad for the first time in India, and you put his quotes in all caps, and he's just exploding on you with this exuberance.
My dad's an interesting guy. When we got off the plane in India, so he lives in Kolkata. The last time I saw him, I was a freshman at Boston University, and my father, he comes up and visits me, and, you know, we kind of have a strained conversation, and then he leaves, and I don't think much of it, and then a couple of weeks later, he leaves to go to India without telling anybody, and then he never comes back. And when I saw him on that visit at BU, he looked kind of old and kind of haggard, like as if life had just kind of beaten him down. So when I got off the plane in Kolkata, this is probably 11, 12 years later, I expected to see that version of him, except 11 years worse.
Yeah.
Right. And when he comes out and we're standing on the side, he kind of burst through the airport doors and he's striding towards us. He looks toned. He looks healthy. He's got a dress shirt on. He's got a haircut. He's shaved. He's got flowers for my fiance, Wesley. And he's like, you know, every sentence is a shout. Hi, how are you? How did the
welcome to India?
Like, welcome to India. And just yelling. Now, part of it's that when you're in India, a lot, you know, there's some of these particularly busier parts. Like, you have to kind of yell because there's honking and there's people yelling all around you. So you have to kind of keep your energy up. But my dad just yells every sentence, man. I kept thinking to myself, where is this guy for the last 30 years of my life? This energetic man who is full of life. And it was a really pretty interesting thing to see. You know, I just did not. That's not something I expected to see out of him.
So I find the writing process of this interesting, especially in those early chapters, because you had to condense pretty much your whole childhood into your college life, like, you know, 20, 25 years of your life into almost one chapter like you did. Like, there's just a massive amount of condensing, and this book really isn't all that long for, you know, a story about your entire life. Like, what is that process like of condensing so much like you did into almost just like this very short pocket early in the book?
You know, it documented a year, and I didn't want this to be a laborious read.
Yeah.
But in some ways, like, you know, in the book contract that the publishing house gives you to sign once you have the book deal, it says this book will be around 75,000 words. So I was kind of mapping it out as I went, but there's a point, it doesn't usually work out like this, but it actually, once I got to the 75,000 word point, I was like, oh, I've said everything I want to say here. That's okay. This is the time for the book to end. And so it actually worked itself out pretty nicely in terms of length. So, you know, I'm fortunate that it happened like that.
I'm sure this comes a little more naturally for you as a comedian, but writing funny is an interesting thing. When I was a junior in high school, I think my teacher told me, just acknowledge off the bat that you're not funny. And then go from there. If there's opportunities to be funny, you can always try to take a risk, but always know that's going to fail in a massive way, probably. And right. That put this fear in me, like, all right, like I kind of see myself being a funny person, like situationally, but when it comes to writing, I think I'll just veer away from that until further along in my career, maybe, where I'm a little more, you know, drilled in the fundamentals to try that out. You know, you're a comedian, you write comedy, have that intersect with a reporting project like this and kind of have that side of you and the reporting side of you come together. Was it natural or did it take a little bit of trial and error?
Well, it's both, but the most important thing is I didn't try to be funny in the book. And I think people that try to be funny often fail at it.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
I was just trying to be honest and I was trying to be myself. So in the course of writing, when I'd make a joke, it would be okay. I would make that joke naturally in the course of a normal conversation, you know, if we were discussing this in real life. So I didn't force jokes in, generally speaking. It was just an expression of my personality and the way I discuss things. Secondly, jokes are like therapy for me. So, you know, when I'm discussing, you know, when I'm trying to be funny, you know, or whatever the word you want to use, I often, when I come across tense situations, what I want to do is crack jokes. Sometimes to my own detriment. Sometimes, like, they're not the right times to make jokes. But it's just how I deal with tense situations anyway. So, but it wasn't, you know, the book is not me trying to be funny. I have no idea if I actually am funny. But it is honest. Whatever the book is, it is who I am as a person. And if you're reading it, you either like that or you don't. And my hope is that people do like that.
Mm-hmm. You have this great section in there where you kind of show your introduction to comedy when you're in the back of the car. You tell this joke about taking a shortcut into a long cut. Yeah. But what actually led you toward getting on stage, doing this in stand-up kind of settings like you have?
Sure. It's not a great story, but basically my college girlfriend from BU broke up with me like a year or two out of college. And I was like, oh, I'm sad. What do sad people do? Oh, sad people become comedians. So I decided to try a comedy. So I started with taking some improv classes at the Magnet Theater, which is in the Chelsea district of Manhattan. And then from there, I started doing stand-up. And you know, I don't do it as much anymore. I mean, for pandemic reasons, but also once I started doing the book, my focus was the book. And I realized I liked writing way more than I liked performing. And so, but you know, comedy was really a form of therapy for me all through my 20s. It allowed me to like talk about all the things that are bothering me and really look inside myself and, you know, but it's hard. Stand-up comedy is hard. It's not for everybody. Improv's for everybody. I highly recommend everyone take an improv class if we're ever allowed out in public again. But, you know, stand-up is hard. Stand-up, you really have to work at it. And so for me, I like writing a lot more than I like doing stand-up. So before the pandemic, I actually was a writer on a newly formed sketch team at the Magnet, which is the theater I described to you before, but unfortunately then the pandemic hit and the whole thing got canceled.
Did you take improv classes, anything to like kind of prepare to jumping into that lane, or did you just kind of dive headfirst into it?
Well, I started with improv classes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I took a profit, I want to say, for like a year and a half, maybe, give or take.
Mm-hmm. And what about it gave you kind of that fulfillment out of it? Because I know you tried therapy. I know you tried all these different things to try to reconcile with what you'd gone through when you were younger. But what gave you something out of comedy that, you know, maybe other places and other outlets didn't?
You know, so with improv, you're creating these whole worlds from scratch.
Yeah.
And the two fundamental tenets of improv are yes and, which means whatever your scene partner says, you have to go along with it and then adding to it. And then secondly, you have to be honest. So what does that mean in practice? If you and I are doing a scene and you're a doctor, okay, and you start the scene and say, oh, I'm a doctor. Well, then I have to say, oh, hello, doctor. I'm your longtime patient, right? And then if you as a doctor tell me that I have cancer, I wouldn't like react by, I don't know, pulling a gun and shooting you, right? That's not an honest reaction. And the audience is going to be like, yeah, that's fucking weird, you know? But if I react by being sad, that's an honest reaction, right? And so, and from there you find the humor, you keep exploring the scene until the humor comes out. And the thing that it really helps you professionally, it helps you be more comfortable with yourself on stage, helps with public speaking. It helps you just feel more confident in yourself. I thought it was great for me. And then once you start doing stand-up, I thought it was great for me to be able to talk about things that were on my mind. Just like in the same way that you do a therapy. But in this case, you're doing it to make people laugh. And there is nothing like when you do a set and you absolutely kill it. There's nothing like feeling. There's no feeling like that. Like the roar from the crowd. Like I will never experience anything like that again.
That's giving me some inspiration. Maybe when this, I'm trying to find these different outlets right now, and you know, trying out the piano, trying out boxing, trying out all these different things just to kind of fill some space in this post grad world. Maybe I'll take an improv class. Maybe that's in my future.
Bobby, even if you have no interest in comedy, I highly recommend taking an improv class. It will help you professionally.
Awesome. So let's get in your professional side. Boston Globe right out of college. Reporting. What led you in those directions? You know, you kind of established yourself as a personality in your teenage and your college years outside of your connection with your parents at that time, as you wrote in the book. But what led you toward reporting as what you want to do professionally at that time?
It's a good question. So I went to college at BU to be a sports broadcaster. That was my initial goal. And then I got really bored with sports. It's actually kind of funny is that, you know, 10 years after graduating college that I'm back covering sports, but I got bored with sports. I don't want to do it anymore. And then from there, I got really interested in documentaries. I was really fascinated by documentary work. And so I wanted to produce documentaries. So my first job was partially in the sports department of the Globe, and then partially I was in the Boston Globe's documentary video unit, which I don't even know if they have anymore. You know, I don't even know if it exists. The Globe is much different than it used to be. And then from there, I worked at a bunch of TV networks producing, you know, long form journalism and doing video work. And then from there, you know, my big break was in 2015 when I got hired to be a campaign embed for CBS News, and I got to cover the Trump campaign. And that was kind of my big break. And that was kind of what put me on a bunch of different radars and how I ended up at the New York Times. And I had a strange career. It's very unusual, in part because of the volatility of the media industry. And secondly, just because I've had just a bunch of opportunities, you know, just kind of pop up every couple of years that are totally different from the previous ones. And I just kind of go with it, man.
How do you feel about that? Because let's say you started 30 years ago, you probably would have went in that documentary lane or whatever it would have been and just kept going straight in that direction right from the start and had that be the one thing you did. Now in 10 years, you've gotten to do five different, entirely different topics, careers, whatever you want to call them. Like there's some good to that and some bad to that, I'd imagine.
You know, 30 years ago, you would not have been able to jump industries in the way that I have and jump beats in the way that I have. You had to be a lot more single tracked, I think. Also 30 years ago, I wouldn't have gotten the opportunities, period, because.
Oh, we can talk about that. 100%.
30 years ago, you know, first of all, as a person of color, it was harder to get, Listen, I don't listen.
That's what you call a blind spot, soap man.
Like the New York Times, you know, probably just, I got hired at the New York Times. I think I was 28 when I got hired at the Times. I think I was 28. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 29. And you know, 30 years ago, they weren't hiring a lot of reporters in their 20s who had never written for a newspaper before. That wasn't something that happened 30 years ago. I don't know if I would have gotten a campaign embed job, you know, when I was 25, you know, in 30 years ago. Those jobs just weren't coming to people that looked like me that were my age. Now it's, in some ways, there isn't as much of a barrier to being young. So it's just a different industry than it was. It's a different industry than it was 3 years ago, let mm-hmm. alone 30 years ago. You know, 30 years ago, you know, let's say you're shooting a TV news story. Let's say you're 60, you know, let's say you're shooting for the CBS Evening News. Well, you might have two cameramen, a correspondent, a producer, an editor, you know, an assistant editor, an assistant producer. That's seven people for one story. Now there are entire evening news pieces shot and edited by one person. You know, and so it's just a different industry than it was 30 years ago.
I saw a small paper in Ithaca, New York, is down to one reporter.
Oh, wow. I mean, that does not surprise me.
Unbelievable. How do you do it? Like, if I'm that one reporter, I'm just kind of throwing up my hand saying, like, this is impossible.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. What can you say? You know, I think what's happened to the media industry, it's quite tragic in the last, you know, two decades or so. And a lot of these jobs are not coming back after the pandemic.
That's a different podcast entirely. And I do have some ideas on that. And there's a lot of different ways we can take that, but, let's take it back to that Trump experience that you had. What it became in 5 years, looking back on 2015 when you first started this, like we all had some idea it was going to be wild, but I think there's probably a better adjective needed for how it ended up going. Like looking back on the experience covering that campaign, you didn't expect it to last too long. It lasted a little while longer and it has continued to last. How do you kind of look back on that experience in retrospect now, given how his presidency has progressed and just the whirlwind of events that have spiraled into 2020 now in his reelection year?
You know what's interesting, Bobby? I get this question quite a bit, and I have to be honest. Maybe this says something about me, and maybe this says something about kind of my experience. I don't remember much of the campaign anymore. And which is why I'm glad I journaled quite a bit during it. And I have a lot of videos and stuff from the campaign, pictures, but that part of my life seems like 20 years ago because of the way the news cycles have gone. In some ways this was totally predictable, just kind of the way that Trump swallows up the news cycle. I whatever has happened, I very rarely find myself surprised after the election. Like if you covered him day in and day out, like I did, went to hundreds of rallies, this is what the Trump experience is. You know, now the difference is he's the president. I remember the only thing I remember about the campaign at this point, and there's certain stories I remember, you know, certain rallies I remember more than others, but what I remember most about the campaign more than anything is how exhausting it was, how tired I was every single day. Because you're waking up early in the morning and checking his Twitter feed. You're going to rallies. You're going to bed late at night because, you know, Trump might be going on Sean Hannity's show. And you're just tired, man.
It's from an outside perspective, I imagine it's a very exhausting experience because it kind of expanded the, category of what's newsworthy. Like all of a sudden, every little stupid thing became something that you had to hop on, and it became like a 24/7 crusade, whether it was Covfefe or just like any of the nonsense, like everything became a story just because it was him.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I just don't know that is, everything is just so crazy all the time. It's like, you're like going 100 miles an hour every single day. And I'm exhausted even now reading the news. I don't cover this stuff. So I don't know if I, you know, if I just one of the privileges I have now as an NBA reporter, whatever, I can unplug a little bit from Trump coverage. You know, I keep up just from a civic duty perspective, but I don't have to keep up on the minute level in the way that someone covering the Trump campaign has, Trump world has to. And that has improved my mental health so much, man. Like I sleep more. I just have a little bit more of a work-life balance than I did during the campaign. And I'm just so much more healthy than I was in 2015, 2016.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting too, how things have circled around in this sense where you were arrested in 2015, in Chicago, 2015, 2016, sometime in there, on live TV. And then to see that circle back to 2020, where we see a CNN reporter arrested on TV, journalists hit with rubber bullets. This segment of this protest that has been going on for 2-3 weeks now, where journalists are kind of caught in the middle of it there. It's an experience you went through back then. Now seeing it play out now, what are some of your feelings on seeing that?
A colleague of mine, on CNN, Omar Jimenez, was arrested on live TV 3 weeks ago, whatever, the first week of the George Floyd protests. And it was happening on live TV. And when I watched it that morning, because it was early in the morning, I woke up and I saw it, I got a little bit of like a PTSD type, whatever. Like I remembered myself getting arrested and thrown to the ground by police and whatever. And then, the stories got worse after that. I mean, there are reporters being, dealing with tear gas and shot with rubber bullets. And I remember there's the one journalist who lost her eye as a result. And then I just found so much of the behavior by police officers is just shocking. What I went through in 2016 was bad, but it's 20 times worse what is going on right now by many, many journalists, so I really admire some of the journalists that are out there and not just risking, kind of the violence, but also the pandemic, putting themselves out there with that. So I really admire the journalists that are out there covering the protests, and it's really necessary for us to see these pictures.
The cycles happen at a much more rapid rate now, I would say, the way things move. Like this is a cyclical thing you would have expected to see over a decade, instead it's 5 years. What led you to move back into a culture type role with the New York Times? Like you talked briefly about them hiring you, but you kind of made a name for yourself covering politics at that time. And you would have maybe expected someone like we thought it said with the, progression there to keep doing that. But the New York Times wanted to hire you in a different level of capacity, it appears. Like how'd that come about? Yeah.
So CBS had offered me a gig to go cover the White House.
And you're like, hell no.
So they actually offered me the gig before the election, and I thought I was gonna go do it, because the thought was that Trump was gonna lose and I'd be able to unplug from Trump world and to start this new job covering the White House. And then Trump won, and I was like, I don't know if this is a good idea, mental health wise, physical health wise. I don't know if this is a good idea, because politics is, even when it's not Trump, it's an overwhelming beat. And the Times reached out, and then we had a couple of conversations. I got along really well with the higher ups there about covering culture. And then you had did stand-up comedy. Then you had quite a bit about culture. And then you had a bunch of interest in it. And then they said, you don't have to go to DC. You could stay in New York, and you don't have to cover Trump. You could just you could cover Trump in a different way. And I was like, this sounds like an incredible opportunity. How can I pass up the New York Times in my 20s? And so I went, and I don't regret it. It's one of the best things I've ever done for myself. I'm really grateful to the Times for hiring me. And, I don't know that without the Times, I get a book deal. I'm very fortunate. These last couple of years have been just very, health-wise, been very good for me.
At what point did you start focusing on the NBA, what you got there?
About 14 months ago. So basically, I've been in culture for two and a half years. And then we hired a new sports editor to run the section. And he came to me one day. He's like, we know you love basketball. Why don't you come write about basketball for us? And initially I was like, I don't know, man. Like, do you want your passion to become work? And then I was like, why not? Let's just see what this is like. And man, this is the best job I've ever had in my life, covering basketball for the Times. You know, it's ludicrous. It's not a real job. You know, I get paid to watch basketball. It's absurd. It's like made up. It's fantasy land. Now, do I take my job very seriously? Yeah, but unless it's like a situation where like what's going on right now, where it's the black connected to the Black Lives Matter movement and whatnot. But in terms of the actual gameplay, like that part itself is not, you know, important in terms of like the betterment of civilization, right? Yeah. And so like, the part of me is like, man, this is not real life that I get to do this for a living. So, you know, it's the best job I've ever had, and I don't know how long I'll do it for, you know, but I'm very fortunate.
How do you feel? That's originally what you wanted to do. It's funny how you pivoted away from it to end up back there, as you talked about. How do you feel like you came into it, given the experiences you had in other beats, lanes, et cetera, versus if you just kept going on that straight line towards sports out of school? Like, do you think you gained a different perspective on things, a different appreciation about how to do the job in particular?
So that's a good question. I think my other experiences have helped me be a different type of NBA reporter. So for example, my politics experience has come in handy in covering the NBA, particularly because the NBA has, you know, more activist minded player, you know, activist minded people, athletes, so to speak. And I, you know, so because I understand politics a little bit more than maybe your average basketball reporter does, you know, that helps me. And then same thing with culture, where the NBA, the players are more intertwined with culture, whether it's in content creation or whatever, than any other major sport. So me understanding how that world works, I think is a boon to the beat than if I had just covered basketball for the last 10 years. So, I think that my kind of diverse sort of history and in the various beats I've covered is helpful. Now, on the other hand, where it's harder is that when you walk onto a beat, you know, everyone else has been on the beat longer than you, not just inside the paper, outside the paper, you know, and so no one in the locker rooms knows who you are. Agents don't know who you are. And so that part can be a little bit difficult to navigate, but so be it.
How have you worked on that? Have you kind of made some progress in that regard? I know that is a tricky thing when you get in the room and you just don't have that familiarity. You almost experience that in college too, to some degree, when you're jumping between the different teams over the 4 years there. Like every single team you land on covering is just a like completely new slate.
Well, I work on it, you know, within the realm of my job, you know, yeah. You know, sourcing up and whatnot the best I can, but I also don't like, I also am not willing to compromise myself to get sourced up. So there's a part of me that's like, listen, I'm a reporter. I'm working on this story. You can either talk to me for the story or you cannot talk to me. Either way, I'm still going to do my story. So it's up to you whether you talk to me or not. And I found that approach to be helpful, you know, and so I don't go out of, like, it doesn't bother me that much that people don't know who I am. In some ways that can be a helpful thing.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable with the way I do my job, and, you know, hopefully all that matters is that my bosses are too.
So we have a story here that developed in the last week, as they have over the last 3 months here. So we might as well talk about it. Kyrie Irving, as Woj put him, the disruptor, in a very scathing ESPN piece on him about him coming out in this phone call last week and making the push to not have the league. Now, Kyrie, it's interesting. In Boston, this is going to be received some way. In Cleveland, this is going to be received some type of way. But really, Kyrie has put his personality out there to the wider basketball audience in a way that I don't think helped him all that much in this situation, where I don't think he made a bad point whatsoever. Like, I think a lot of players were thinking this, that we're in this moment right now where quite a large number of players, Malcolm Brogdon, Jaylen Brown, LeBron James, among many others, have taken a stand in this Black Lives Matter movement that has gained startling support. Like, I see this poll that 68% of the country in one poll supports the protests. Upwards of 80% think that racism is a problem at this moment. Like, there's a massive amount of momentum here that I think everybody is shocked by. And Kyrie just brings up this one point that, should we stop this? Now, here's where it becomes a Kyrie thing. This is the quote. I'm not going to Orlando. I'm not with the systematic racism and the bullshit. That's the presentation. And I think that's where he loses a lot of people, because his presentation isn't always the sharpest, which, you know, has its own kind of issues, because different people are going to present things in different types of ways.
So I'd actually like to hear from Kyrie himself before going too deeply on his feelings on the situation, because we haven't heard from him. Everything we've heard about the Kyrie meeting has been through anonymous leaks.
Secondhand sources, yeah.
Secondhand sources. So we don't actually know where Kyrie stands on this. And Kyrie kind of has a history of kind of being all over the place with his views. And so I'm unclear as to where Kyrie is on this. Is his position that if we come back to play, we are taking momentum away from Black Lives Matter, that we are that we shouldn't come back to play right now because we can make a better stand right now by not playing? And you know what? Maybe that's a reasonable position, totally. But I'd like to hear that from him, because I don't know that that's his actual position. Because his position very well might also be, I'm against systemic racism, so how can we use return to play as a way to bring more attention to it? But we don't know that, because Kyrie hasn't actually said anything. I think he Instagrammed one thing where he Instagrammed one player's, like, kind of anonymous quote. He Instagrammed a player quoting him, and it was, like, very unclear as to what the actual quote meant. So I don't actually know if Kyrie is skipping Orlando or not. Secondly, I feel like it should be noted that Kyrie would, you know, he wasn't going to play this summer anyway, you know, with the shoulder likely. So it's I'm a little unclear as to what what Kyrie's angle is here. I would just like to hear from him. I'm not saying that he's operating with any nefarious intent or anything like that. I would just like to hear exactly where he stands, and so, you know, because players don't seem to know either. That's the first. Second of all, leaving aside Black Lives Matter, there are a lot of health questions that have to get addressed by the NBA. It's clear that this has been done in a really, you know, cart before the horse kind of way. For example, are Disney employees going to be allowed in and out of the bubble? If so, then is it a bubble? You know, and if it is not a bubble, then can players go in and out? And if players can go in and out, well, then what are we doing here? You know, are you just actively putting people at risk at that point? And then this all comes at the same time as Florida cases are rising, Orange County cases are rising, where Walt Disney World is. So, well, is this actually, do we need basketball right now to come back while the pandemic is rising in the place where you are trying to play? And that's a question I think Adam Silver is going to have to answer.
About a million different things come at an intersection here, because Kyrie himself reportedly was saying he wanted to go to Orlando to be with his team earlier in the week. So I think that's where part of the messaging, if there is any there, kind of becomes tricky. The bubble is such an interesting conversation, because at its core, it's a tool to keep everybody safe here. Fauci approves of it. It seems like a plan that would be approved by health experts generally. But this question comes in about, which I think Shams reported, that if someone leaves the bubble, there'll be a 14-day quarantine, which to some degree is almost like, you hate to put it this way, but like a 14-day suspension. Like, if you're leaving this bubble, if you step outside of the confines of your job, you're suspended for 2 weeks. And I think that's part of the rhetoric that the players don't love all that much, because we know what kind of world we live in from a coverage perspective. TMZ will find a player at the club or at the bar or something like that. And if it's a notable player, all of a sudden the NBA has a big question. Are they going to step in and take a stand on their rules and, in essence, make their mark on the competitive balance of what's going on out there? Because there will be someone out there, probably not at a high level, but, you know, maybe a mid-tier or lower-tier player that could still be important in one of these teams. And if they get seen outside the bubble, that's my biggest question. Like, I think the asterisk question has been kind of dumb from the start, just in terms of everybody having equal hardship here. But if one team has a guy who's outside the bubble and then all of a sudden there's a big controversy about that, like, I do think there's a legitimate, like, conflict of interest there on the league's part. Like, do we step in and uphold our rules, or do we kind of distort the competition here? Like, that is a situation I could 100% see playing out. Now, honestly, I would be surprised if it didn't play out.
And not just the league, it's also its broadcast partner, ESPN, as well. Because ESPN is not just a broadcast partner. ESPN is also hosting this whole thing, right? Because it's on the ESPN campus at Walt Disney World. So I think we should be honest about this, which is that, and yeah, as Mark Stein wrote for us last week, look, this is first and foremost, this is a money play by the league. They have to recoup some of this TV money, you know, and if they don't recoup some of this TV money, next year's season is in a lot of trouble, you know, and if the data is showing that COVID cases predominantly affect people that are older, well, then we have to get back some of this TV. I mean, that's the calculation here, you know, regardless of, you know, we can have these conversations about Black Lives Matter and blah, blah, blah. But on the league side, you know, this is a conversation about money, you know, and there's just no point in pretending otherwise. Right. And so the question is, you know, risk versus reward. Is the reward of you getting some of the TV money back worth the risk of getting coronavirus? And, you know, who knows? And the players are going to have to make the decision for themselves. And then, you know, and then every morning that the NBA is at Walt Disney World, everyone's going to be just waking up and praying, please, nobody get COVID. Please, nobody get COVID. Because, you know, and if you're acting on that, well, then is that a safe place, safe way to come back? Who knows?
When this happened in March, it felt so solidified. And I'm just thinking, like, this is still an enormous undertaking. This was always going to be really hard. And it was put out there in such simplistic terms that initially I don't think enough people realized just how unlikely this was going to be. Like, it feels right now like there's a much greater chance that this does not happen than it does, despite the fact that it's been signed off and ratified and everything else. It wouldn't be stunning in the next 2 weeks, because the testing starts June 23rd. If there's some positive tests there, they say this is going to get going July 31st, July 30th, one of those dates. This could, like, if something goes wrong and these concerns continue to linger, it feels like this could legitimately be off the table by July. Like, they have to attempt it. That's the hard thing. Adam Silver said it himself, I think. There's no good choice here. The players, to some degree, have a money play, too. You said on the league side, there's a money play.
Oh, look, Ed Davis. I mean, I was just – Ed Davis gave an interview to Alex Kennedy of Hoops Hype that was, you know, I was reading. And Davis made the point, like, look, it's easy for Kyrie and Dwight Howard to say, hey, let's sit this out, you know, let's make a stand. They have, you know, I think Ed Davis is that close. Dwight Howard has a $20 million mansion, right? Given that that's the case, look, Kyrie and Dwight Howard are like the 1% in the league, right? Ed Davis has not made that much money. I mean, he's made a significant amount of money, but he hasn't made like Kyrie level money. So yeah, I mean, the money is will be a paramount thing to both. But I will say one thing that makes this a little different is that the NBA played 80% of its season. So it's not like Major League Baseball where they're looking at a third of their season. The NBA played most of their season. They played 80% of their games. So in proportion to other sports, the NBA probably doesn't make – the players don't make out as badly because of their guaranteed contracts as players in other sports. But.
Yeah, for sure. But there's just long-term implications here. I want to hear some of those from you as well, like from our perspective in the media, from the players' perspective in terms of CBA negotiations that could linger into next year. These are hefty consequences on all sides of not attempting this. So I see the Twitter conversation make it look so easy, like, just shut this down. It looks terrible. It's not that easy on that end either. Like, if there was nothing on the line going forward, I think the league probably would shut this down. But Silver, the owners, who I think have been fairly compensatory towards Silver being a figure who's a little more sympathetic of the players than most commissioners are, all of a sudden, if this season gets canceled, I think Silver gets put in a position where all of a sudden he has to be the owner's guy, like, going forward, and kind of play that role more than he has so far.
Yeah, I think that that's a bridge to cross when you get there.
Yeah.
Because who knows? Who knows? Because Silver's trying to get rescued this season right now. And then if this season gets canceled, that's when the conversation changes.
What do you make of him saying that players who don't want to go don't have to go? Is it as simple as that, you think? Because certain guys are just going to sit out. I know Enes Kanter said that there's guys considering this. And then Malcolm Brogdon, of course, said there's other notable guys as well who are just considering not going. And that's aside from Irving being that he wouldn't be playing anyway.
I don't that's not surprising. You can't make them. The question is whether they get paid or not. So if you're Enes Kanter, I'm not saying Enes would do this, but Enes Kanter says, I don't want to come back. I don't feel right about it. I don't feel safe. But I'm not injured. I just don't want to come back. The question is whether he gets paid or not. And that's going to be the sticking point. And we don't know the answer to that yet.
And so here we stand. Like life, basketball is still about as uncertain as it was back in March. He's Soap Van Deb. You can get his book, Mistranslations, anywhere you can get books. Thanks for being with us here, Soap.